will continue the presentation on historical water budget results. After each of these agenda items, there will be a question and answer period. Today, this is a technical webinar, so you will all be muted, and I will be able to unmute you during the question and answer period. We'll only take questions and answers during those designated times, and I ask that you raise your hand once we start the Q&A if you'd like to ask a question of clarification or make some comments. I'd also like to let you know that at the VINA Subbasin Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting, which will be taking place on June 16th, that there will be further discussion about these topics. We realize that there's so much information to cover that it was well suited to doing a technical webinar, and then we would also have further opportunities for more robust discussion on these topics at the SHAC. After Byron makes that presentation at the 2 o'clock hour on historical water budget results, we will take a 15-minute break. As we know, it's quite a lot to be on these Zoom calls for multiple hours. We'll come back after a 15-minute break, and Byron will continue a presentation on water budget scenarios and comparisons. And then we'll just, Christina will give us a sense of what the next steps are and where we go from here. Christina, I'm going to go ahead and stop my screen there. I'll hand it over to you to make any other opening remarks, and then you can share your presentation.
Okay, great. Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks, Tanya. Happy to be here with all of you in this strange but virtual setting. And as Tanya mentioned, there's a lot of information coming out as part of the Basin Setting Project. This is a project that is really developing content for portions of the groundwater sustainability plans under SGMA in each of the three subbasins that Butte County is a part of. So that's VINA, Wyandotte Creek, and the Butte Subbasin. And so today we're focusing on the VINA Subbasin, of course, and David's Engineering is the consultant team that's been doing that technical work and working with us on those pieces. So today we had outlined at the last SHAC that the SHAC members were going to get a presentation of an update. They received an update on the kind of status of the Butte Basin groundwater model calibration, and then also historical groundwater conditions. And then what remained to be presented and was not presented there was historical water budget information and then the water budget scenarios. And so what we're gonna do today, we added a piece, and that is what I'm gonna cover to kick us off here is at least components of the hydrogeologic conceptual model. We'll talk about what that is. It's not gonna be a complete story yet, but wanted to begin to set the stage, and I think it sets a nice foundation to then hear and get the details on the water budget results, the preliminary results. So that Byron's going to cover this afternoon as well. So we hope that we can cover a lot of information and then have some time to respond to questions and provide clarification and really begin to build additional familiarity with some of these terms, concepts. Some of you have been around and involved and are familiar with this stuff, and others not as much. So hopefully we can kind of hit both audiences well, but look forward to really just the beginning of rolling out this information. So that's what we're gonna do today. All of this is gonna be posted. As Tanya mentioned, this is recorded. And the portions of the SHAC meeting from last month were also recorded. And so we'll post kind of all of those pieces will be available for those that weren't able to tune in or aren't on today to view at their leisure. So that will be available as well. So with that, I think I will share my screen here. Just a minute. Okay. It's It's always odd to not know exactly what you guys are seeing. Okay, do I need to swap it?
Yeah. Okay, perfect.
Okay, we set? Okay, great. Okay, so one of the things that what the Basin Setting Project, like I mentioned, is developing documentation specifically that will be included in the Groundwater Sustainability Plan. The plan has to be adopted by January 2022, so we have some time. But it's really, this basin setting work is really understanding what's the lay of the land in the sub-basin. And that lays the foundation for then having the discussions around minimum thresholds, sustainable management criteria, management, and policy type actions. So today is the technical kind of background for some of those future conversations. So SGMA, one of its requirements was that you include in your basin setting this hydrogeologic conceptual model. And we use model in a lot of different ways, so that can be confusing, just that word. But this really is a conceptual model. It's our concepts or ideas around how groundwater moves in and through the subbasin, how water is moving into the subbasin, into the aquifer systems, and really trying to capture and just describe the physical characteristics that are at play in the subbasin. So in some ways, if you're familiar with our area, which many of you are, this is kind of obvious stuff, right? Like, we know that these things exist and are happening, these different activities, on the one hand. And then the more complicated piece is, what is the groundwater system, aquifer system, geology, hydrogeology, what does that look like? And we're going to fall short a bit today in diving into that, but we'll touch on it. And the AEM study, and I'll talk about this as well, that data was collected by a helicopter back in 2018, will continue to feed into better pictures for us of what the subsurface looks like and how it's connected. So that's kind of a preview, overview of where I'm going with this whole thing. So the DWR has this document that gives you information about how to put together your hydrogeologic conceptual model and what it should include. And so it describes that fundamentally this HCM provides an understanding of the general physical characteristics related to the regional hydrology, land use, geology, the structure of the aquifer system, geologic structure, water quality, principal aquifers, principal aquitards of the basin setting. So we're going to cover quite a bit of that today and show some of the maps that have been put together for this documentation. But I'm also going to talk about some previous work that's been done that is helping inform our understanding of how groundwater kind of works around here. So it's all of that provides the context then for developing the water budgets or mathematical models like the Butte Basin groundwater model and the monitoring network. So you've basically identified in your HCM, what are the different activities, what are the different physical characteristics and things present in the subbasin, and then you would expect to see those components and aspects described or included in your water budgets and modeling and monitoring networks so that you could track them. So like I said, this is kind of a big picture overview of what's going on. These are the specific components and a map set. And can you see my cursor when I move my arrow? Okay. And the maps that are required, I'm going to have some of them today and some of them are still to come. I'm going to move this out of the way a little bit. Okay, so, but I'm going to mostly tell you a story today about how does water get kind of into the Vina subbasin, that is the groundwater system of the Vina subbasin, and how does it get out? So just, you know, stepping back and kind of thinking big picture about how water is moving in and through this system, because understanding that is, of course, important basis for then making decisions about how we protect that or manage it into the future. So so just physical characteristics of the landscape, right? This is a general cartoon that includes a lot of the things that we have present in the Vina subbasin as well, but there's some others that aren't relevant. But we can think, of course, irrigated agriculture has a dominant place on the landscape. City of Chico, urban area, rural residential property, and well owners concentrated kind of in the Durham area, but sprinkled throughout the sub-basin. We have a major river, the Sacramento River, being the western boundary, or at least a portion of the western boundary of the sub-basin. Other creeks and streams that traverse the sub-basin coming from the eastern foothills and heading toward the Sacramento River, including Butte Creek, Big Chico Creek, but then others, a whole set of kind of ephemeral streams, right, that flow during the wet season and then dry up when there are not rains or during the summer. And then riparian areas, refuge areas, and ecosystems that are also an important part of the landscape. So just kind of big picture, kind of punch list of what are those things on across the landscape of the Vina Subbasin. So land use, just snapshot of that, right? Primarily in the irrigated areas, orchard crops dominate. There's some rice, this aqua color. The city of Chico is a significant footprint as well. And then on the eastern side, this kind of yellowish color is native land, right? So that's unirrigated pasture land or rangeland. And so that's a pretty significant portion of the Vina Subbasin as well. So I'm gonna go through just a couple other kind of surface characteristics of the basin. So surface water hydrology map here, some of those things that I mentioned before, just to orient us a little bit, if you're not familiar with the kind of domain of the Vina Subbasin, we have the northern boundary is the Tehama Butte County line, and then the Sacramento River, which is actually also the Butte Glen County line, comes down here. This is where Big Chico Creek comes in to the Sacramento River, so the boundary follows that a little bit, comes around, if you're familiar with M&T Ranch, Llano Seco, and then the Western Canal Water District service area boundary here along the south. And then Bulletin 118 is the DWR groundwater bulletin that defined kind of the edge of the alluvium, and that's what serves as this eastern boundary of the subbasin. So that's kind of what we're talking about in terms of area, and these, you know, streams come out of these foothill areas across the subbasin and head to the south and southwest. Okay, so those are the types of kind of primary surface water systems that we want to have on our radar and might want to account for in a tool like the Butte Basin Groundwater Model, or in water budgets, or in monitoring, right? So this is just kind of taking a lay of the land in terms of what are the things that we need to be aware of as we go into those other areas of analysis. So soils is a piece of it also, soil characteristics, and those affect both land use footprint, right? What crops are grown where are sensitive to infiltration and drainage properties of soil. So that's an important backdrop. And then recharge, right? Just natural recharge and percolation rates are sensitive to infiltration capacity of soils. And then you can see on the eastern side, right, pretty low infiltration category of soil along there. And yet we'll talk about how there's evidence that that's a significant source of recharge area as well. So when you have, even if it's running off and then finding pathways into the groundwater system, that can occur as well. Surficial geology, so this is a map of the geologic formations at the surface. And then of course, these geologic formations are underground as well and in different areas. You'll hear and are probably familiar with the Tuscan Formation. It's a geologic formation that makes up a lot of the materials in the aquifer system of the Vina Subbasin. We also have kind of on top of that, a shallower alluvium, which is basically just material that was laid down by more recent activity of creeks and streams and the Sacramento River across the landscape. And then some other formations as well that are in more distinct places. The Tehama Formation comes in from the west and is present at depth and kind of interlayers with the Tuscan Formation. And then down in the southeast area, Lovejoy Basalt is present as well. So formations and geologic history is important in providing context for how this material, what the characteristics of the material is, and how it was laid down and kind of got there, right? And in relation to each other. But we also know, and we'll talk about this, that the kind of aquifer properties, we talk about how well water moves through the aquifer material. So, you know, if you pour water through a flower pot that's full of gravel and sand, it drains right through, right? So it has good transmissivity. If it's full of clay, it ponds on top and it slowly soaks in, but not very much of it drains out the bottom. So clay can hold water well, but doesn't allow water to move through it very well. So when you have an aquifer system that's a mix, an interlayering of those sands and gravels as well as clays, that is kind of describing the characteristics or the properties of the groundwater aquifer. And that can be Tuscan formation, or it can be Tehama formation or the alluvium. And they each have kind of different properties, but we also know that the Tuscan formation, you know, covers underground a lot of this area, most of the Vina subbasin, but its properties vary from kind of closer to its source area up here in the northeast, where that volcanic source was, even further to the east. It's more cemented, maybe more distinct layering, and less connectivity with depth. And then it got, as it moved into the valley and was reworked by river systems over geologic time, its properties changed and it's more reworked. So geology is an important background, understanding kind of where these materials came from and at what times in history. But then the other processes that were at play are also important for understanding kind of how that affects actual groundwater aquifer properties in terms of the materials are, or how connected different zones are. Okay, so more to come on that. We're not really going to dive into that specifically for the Vina subbasin today. So we're going to talk more kind of on the conceptual side of how water moves through groundwater systems. So we'll return to my original kind of question is, first, how does water get into Vina subbasin, right? Into any subbasin, there's two kind of primary options. Groundwater recharge, and that's flow of water from the surface down into the groundwater system to the water table where those materials are saturated. It's actually difficult to directly measure recharge, right? And to estimate it, there's inherent uncertainty in any kind of approach or method. And so in groundwater and a lot of pieces of groundwater science, we use multiple lines of evidence to really understand how much and where recharge is naturally occurring. So, but if you just think, right, what are the options? What are the potential sources? We've got precipitation that falls on the land surface and soaks in and makes its way down to the groundwater system. We have potentially applied water for irrigation, right? Water that's not used for crops. And then the rivers and streams that flow across the subbasin can soak in as well and become a recharge source potentially. And then the other big kind of possible bucket source is subsurface groundwater flow. And we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So first, let's talk about groundwater recharge. Hold on one second, I'm going to swing my door shut. Sorry about that. So recharge processes, right, can occur over a broad area. So this is a picture of the foothills, right? Precipitation falling on this eastern side where we know there a lot of precipitation occurs, and it more and more as you move up the foothills, right? A lot more precipitation in rainfall amounts in Paradise than in Chico, even significantly different. So broad aerial recharge, right? That can be from precipitation or from applied water. And this is a picture of a rice field. Not a lot of surface water irrigated land in the Vina subbasin. So that happens some, but is probably less prominent. And you'll see in the water budget numbers how precipitation plays an important role as a source for percolation to the groundwater system. Okay, the other option is, you know, kind of recharge at a specific location, and that could be a river, you know, along the course of a river where water is moving from the river into the groundwater system or a body of water, whether it's a pond or a lake or whatnot. Main things in the Vina Subbasin would be our rivers and streams potentially providing a source of recharge. Those are the natural processes. Then, of course, in some subbasins, but not here, you potentially have a managed aquifer recharge project where you're spreading water across the land surface to move more water into the ground. So all of this, though, is dependent on the connectivity of the land of what's happening on the surface into the actual aquifer system, right? And so I want to just touch on this. A lot of times we see in groundwater kind of these generalized pictures of what the subsurface looks like. Confining layer of clay and then aquifer and really this is not a good picture of groundwater in the Sacramento Valley. Mostly it looks more like this. We want to think of it more as this network of channels, right? That the Sacramento River and other streams over geologic time have deposited gravels and sands where there was the channel, and then there were floodplains, you know, outside of that. And these channels moved around within the valley, and the floodplains moved around, and it's created really this interconnected network that's works a bit more like the veins in our body that carry, you know, blood throughout our body, and then the tissue is saturated as well, and there's interconnection between the tissue and kind of the vein network, but they're connected. There's a lot of connection in 3D. So even if you drill a well and you see kind of like clay and then sands, gravels, clay, sand, gravel, it looks like, okay, wow, there's a lot of clay here. Maybe this sand is disconnected from this sand. But in 3D, this network may actually connect those different depths, even though it looks like there's this big fat clay layer in between. So that's just kind of a concept. I think we want to start to have this picture more in our mind, even though it's a cartoon as well, and just beginning to layer in some of the complexity of what the groundwater system looks like, and why we see different conditions in terms of groundwater levels in different places, and why recharge in one location may really make it into deeper zones because there is this kind of 3D connection potentially. So just thinking again about basin geometry, this is another just general picture of what the valley kind of looks like, right? We've got, if you're looking south, we've got the foothills on mountains on the east side there, alluvial fans into the groundwater alluvial basin, where you have these layers of fine grained materials, which is in the dark gray here, and then aquifer zones, you know, interspersed, and some connection between them, and other places there's less connection. So this is where, that's as far as we're going to get kind of in picturing the underground in terms of what the structure looks like. So that is still to come. I'm going to talk some about studies that have helped us understand where the water is coming from and how it's getting into these different portions of the aquifer system. But the AEM study, which collected geophysical data of the subsurface, and define kind of these different aquifer zones better for the Vina Subbasin. And that is still to come in the next month or two, and it will get incorporated into the HCM documentation, but we're not quite there yet. So some of you, I'm sure, are very disappointed that it's not gonna be part of our conversation today, but it is coming. So we've done a number of studies to better understand groundwater, the groundwater system. And I'm going to give some of the highlights of mostly of these first two. And then this third one, AEM survey, is what I was just talking about. Continuing to try to move our understanding, advance our understanding around some of these questions that we've had for a long time. So the Lower Tuscan Aquifer Investigation was completed in 2013, and it did a number of things. A couple of new monitoring wells went in as part of that study. They did some infiltration testing, some stream flow, and some isotope analysis. So kind of a lot of different types of data collected to try to understand and test some hypotheses at the time that that we were kicking around in terms of how water got into, how the lower Tuscan is recharged. So here's a few of the bullet points of what we learned from that study. One, there was the thought that where the Tuscan formation outcrops on the east side and those streams cross it, that's an important recharge. That was thought to be an important recharge source to the Tuscan aquifer system as it moves into the valley at depth. And what they found in the measurements there is that it was small, or really not even in the reaches that they measured stream flow upstream and downstream, there was no kind of measurable difference. So no measurable leakage of that stream into the groundwater system in those canyon reaches. So that led to thinking, okay, if it's not happening there in the canyon reaches, what about when those streams move into the valley where you have more of the alluvial system? And the importance of this broad aerial recharge across that low foothill area. So that was kind of the new or refined hypothesis, I guess, coming out of that study. And we'll talk about how the next study kind of built on that. Other pieces, significant recharge shallow, potential in the shallow alluvial aquifer that then is connected to these deeper Tuscan formation aquifer materials. But questions remained about how vertically connected are they, how and where are they connected? And the AEM study questions continue to advance, try to advance our understanding and continue to answer some of those questions. So more to come on that. I already talked about this some, but really demonstrated through aquifer pump tests in different locations that the Tuscan formation characteristics are variable. So the Tuscan formation doesn't have kind of a set properties, aquifer properties. It changes as you move kind of from the north, northeast to the southwest and toward the center of the valley. And in some places we see significant leakage through these aquitard, through these clay layers that separate these aquifer zones. And so we don't have in many places, a strictly confined system. There's kind of connectivity or communication between shallower and deeper zones, even when you have pretty thick clay layers in some cases. And so of course, any good study comes out with new questions and additional recommendations. And this one did that as well. And one of those was do some more stable isotope sampling. They did a little bit as part of the study. It was interesting. And so we built on that. And the Stable Isotope Recharge Project then, its goal was to develop a better understanding of overall recharge mechanisms in the general area of Butte Creek. So more sampling of wells in the Butte Creek area. The blue on this map are where wells were sampled. So here's Butte Creek right here just to orient you. And so a number of multi-completion wells were sampled. And out of that, essentially stable isotopes of water can tell us some things about the characteristics of the water that was recharged. So tell about the elevation at which it was recharged, or actually at which it fell, not where it recharged. So the source of the water where it fell as precipitation. So if it fell as rain or snow in the upper watershed, it has a high elevation kind of signature to that actual water molecule. Or if it fell in the lower foothill band, it has kind of that elevation signature or valley floor. So this study kind of identified these three kind of source areas. And here's some of the things that we learned. One, this may be obvious, but it's true. There's no single source of groundwater recharge in Butte County. It depends, kind of the predominant source of recharge depends on where you're at and what depth you're at kind of in the groundwater system. Just keeping an eye on the time. So different parts of the basin are recharged from different sources. So in the vicinity of Butte Creek, where you have Butte Creek and even the Sacramento River, bringing high elevation water into the valley, well samples from those upper portions of the basin, which is still pretty deep, 400 feet, showed high elevation characteristics. So that's suggesting that those streams are sources of recharge to the groundwater system. In areas like this eastern area over here, where you don't have those higher elevation streams, it's really just local runoff and precipitation on the low foothills. Samples from wells in that area showed kind of from top to bottom low elevation foothill source water. So again, that's emphasizing the importance of precipitation and rainfall, both on those lower foothill areas and in the valley. That water makes its way into the ground, not only in the shallow system, but it's moving down into the deeper, deepest zones of the groundwater system as well. And then in the southern area, which is down here in Western Canal, it's in the Butte sub-basin actually, there was evidence of irrigation water in the shallow portions as well. So there's some evidence there that you do have percolation of irrigated water into the shallow zone. So water budgets can help kind of then, so those studies really helped us get a better idea of the mechanisms, the processes by which water is getting into the ground. Water budgets then help us evaluate and estimate the contribution of these different possible sources and get an idea of the relative importance of them. And that can be important for just understanding the sensitivity of the groundwater system overall to different changes. So if stream flow is a really important recharge source and you're anticipating change in that, then you can understand that then that's that has bigger implications for groundwater conditions than if it's a small piece of the pie. So, and where that's occurring matters as well. Okay, so I've mentioned this a couple of times already. I probably should have had this slide in my presentation. So this is just the helicopter that flew. These are the areas that were flown and collected geophysical data here on the west side. And this really is an interesting area where the Tuscan Formation coming from the eastern side and the Tehama Formation from the west, inner finger and kind of inner layer in the middle of the basin. And so this is Glenn County, Butte County, and we have portions of a few different sub-basins in this area, the Vina sub-basin, the Corning sub-basin, the Colusa sub-basin, and a little piece of the Butte sub-basin. So lots of action there. And then an eastern piece over here too, wanting to better understand, you know, out of the staple isotope study, learning that this low elevation precipitation in this low elevation foothill area is an important recharge source, wanting to understand better what's the connectivity there, what's the materials in the subsurface, on the surface and in the subsurface there, that allows for that movement of water into the groundwater system. So this study has a number of kind of driving questions, and you'll see that they're really built on some of the questions that came out of those earlier studies, really trying to delineate better the major aquifer and aquitard units to help inform our hydrogeologic conceptual model. And that's what I was mentioning earlier, that we do expect the AEM work and analysis to do that. So stay tuned for that. I think we'll have some better pictures and a better definition of kind of shallow, intermediate, deep zone definition, not just around kind of depth zones, but tied better to hydrogeology and geology characteristics. So that is to come in the near future, probably later this summer. And we've really benefited from Todd Green, Professor Green at Chico State, geology professor, is a key partner and team member of that study, bringing a lot of valuable local knowledge and interpretation to that data set. So he'll be helping to define some of those things. And tying that then back to our monitoring network wells as well, and better understanding, okay, this well, what kind of aquifer system or zone is it actually monitoring? So moving to the second piece, okay, so we've kind of talked about how does water get into the system? What are those potential kind of big picture sources and some of the mechanisms in a high-level conceptual way. And then how does water get out of the subbasin, right? Of course, groundwater pumping is a primary one. The Vinus subbasin, is a largely groundwater-dependent subbasin. So groundwater pumping, you'll see in the water budget numbers, is a significant outflow from the subbasin. Subsurface groundwater flow is another way that water gets in or out, right? So that these boundaries drawn around the area of the Vinus subbasin are not barriers to groundwater flow. So there's potential movement of groundwater across those lines underground. And then stream groundwater interaction, right? We talked about that as a potential recharge source, but it's also a potential outflow from the groundwater system into the surface water system as additional stream flow. So we've got just a picture of well infrastructure. This is an older image from the 2016 Water Inventory Analysis Report, just to give you an idea of the distribution of wells and density of wells in the Vina subbasin. These actually has the old subbasin boundaries on it, but Vina being right around in here. And we can also add to this information about the depths of these wells and in some cases screen intervals, although we don't have that information for all the wells that are out there. So this will become important information as well as we move into sustainable management criteria and understanding kind of what are the characteristics of the wells that are out there that that may be vulnerable or that policy may want to protect through groundwater management. Subsurface flow. This is a picture of groundwater contours. At the SHAC meeting last month, historical groundwater conditions presentation was given there that talked more about groundwater levels throughout the subbasin and contours and movement. And so if you want more details on some of that data, like I said, that will be posted and you can view that directly. But I put this in here to just talk about kind of the concept of groundwater flowing from areas of higher elevation to lower elevation. And that applies both kind of laterally across the landscape, generally from the east, kind of following the topography, to the southwest or toward the Sacramento River in most cases, but it's also affected by groundwater depressions, right? So where there's a lot of pumping and groundwater levels have declined, down here, especially in the Durham area, you can see these contours swing up, you know, to the east. And that's because there's been declines there. And so you can see some evidence of that and water is flowing kind of toward that area of decline as well. So contour maps give us an idea of direction of flow. And so it helps us tell the story on which direction across the boundary lines as well. Water is flowing. Volume, like what the actual number of how much water is flowing across that boundary, is a bit trickier, and it's dependent on aquifer characteristics, and you'll hear more on that in the water budget numbers, but this is kind of the concept behind some of that. And of course it's dynamic, right? As groundwater levels change, that gradient or how steep the difference is between water levels in one place to another place affects how much flow occurs across that area. So it's time dependent as groundwater levels are changing. And then just the last piece is stream groundwater interaction, right? Whether it's a recharge source or whether water is actually popping out of the groundwater system, moves into the groundwater system, flows laterally. And then if the stream is the low point, then or a wetland area, then you have surface water that groundwater that basically becomes surface water and contributes to stream flow. And you'll see that in the water budget numbers as well. So with that, I wanna wrap up and just again say that what's missing from today are some geologic cross-sections. That is a requirement of the HCM and a requirement of the law for this section. And those are under development. And we held off because there are some existing cross-sections that are useful and helpful. DWR produced cross-sections for the Northern Sacramento Valley as part of their 2014 geologic report. We have some cross-sections from the Lower Tuscan Aquifer Study and some others. So So some existing cross sections will be used and built upon and then added to based on the AEM data set as well. And like I mentioned, wanting to really clarify some of our terminology in terms of how we refer to different kind of portions or zones of the aquifer system. So that is coming and should be a really helpful foundation that will be in place, expected to be in place before we kind of launch into sustainable management criteria. I think some standardization around that will help us and should be in place by the late summer or early fall when we start to really move more into the development of those other pieces of the GSP. So with that, I hope that that helps kind of frame up just thinking about what's happening on the land surface, what are the characteristics of water uses, soils, hydrology, how those things then interact with the groundwater system. And that becomes really the different pieces of the story that we want to understand better through water budget estimates and monitoring. So I think that's it. And
thank you, Christina.
Yeah.
So we're gonna stop here, take a pause for questions. And Christina, we might need you to pop up your screen again if somebody has a question related to any one of your slides. So we do want to take a little bit of time to take any questions that you might have on Christina's presentation. And a refresher for those of you who've done this before, and there may be some first timers on Zoom, we'd like to ask you to raise your hand if you have a question. And how you do that is you go to your main tab, click onto the participant tab, which has sort of an icon of two people standing shoulder to shoulder. And then you'll see a bunch of nonverbal cues at the bottom of the participant list. And you can raise the blue hand. And then I'll ask you to unmute, and you can unmute yourself again on that main toolbar that says mute, unmute. Gary Cole, I see that your hand is up. You can go ahead and unmute yourself.
Yes, my comment or question is, all of this is extremely important and great. To me, it seems like there is one issue that hasn't really been addressed, and that is the rate or time of movement of water, whether it happens to be the rate of flow for recharge, whether it is from precipitation, moving from wherever it enters the aquifer down into the basin, the rate of movement of water through the basin, if it's an unconfined basin, and actually out of the basin, how fast does that move through before that has a negative effect on our volume of water that we could have used or might use and so forth. And is there anything, Christina, in the works for determining better the rate of movement and being able to enter this into the computer program?
Yeah, great question. Thanks, Gary, for that. So rate of movement, I mean, really that is actually an aquifer property, right? We call it hydraulic conductivity. How fast does that material allow water to move through it? And that is a rate. And so estimates of hydraulic conductivity can be estimated based on aquifer pumping tests, so aquifer tests. And so we had some estimates that came out of the Lower Tuscan Aquifer Study. And this is actually a required piece of the HCM documentation as well. So there will be a section there where we include a couple of those different sources of estimates. And the other piece is that the groundwater model, the kind of two primary aquifer parameters that you have to calibrate and use to calibrate the groundwater model is hydraulic conductivity and then the storativity. So how well does water move through the material and how well does the material store water? And so we'll also report out the hydraulic conductivity numbers that are currently in the groundwater model. And really that's, you know, there's a range of reasonable values for that. And then you turn the knob kind of within that reasonable range until your simulated or calculated groundwater levels by the model roughly match what you're observing in your groundwater level monitoring data. So there's a couple sources there for getting an idea of what that rate is. The other thing I know there are some folks, and actually I think maybe I see her on the call, working with Jean Moran to get an idea of residence time. So how long does the water spend kind of in the subbasin? And looking at both water quality data, so age data and isotope data, and comparing that to how the groundwater model is representing that. So that is in the works, I believe. I'm not sure what their timeline is, but it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that study as well, which I think can also add to our understanding of what you're asking about.
Thank you, Gary. Any other questions? I don't see any other hands up. And if you are a caller and you're not logged into Zoom, you can unmute yourself from your phone. If you're having any difficulty unmuting yourself from the phone, you can try *6, and that usually does the job. I see a couple of other hands here. Amy Raymond, go ahead and unmute yourself. There you go.
Yeah. Hi, Christina. Amy Raymond with Rock Creek. I had a question on the well inventory. If you had, and I know it's sensitive subject to know what volume wells are pumping, but do we may have a surrogate of the size or of the well or the pump horsepower that might be on it to get estimates of what the volume that might be pumped off of these well counts?
On these ones? So just size-wise, generally irrigation wells, well, they're actually large diameter wells. So you go into environmental health to get a well permit. It's a large diameter well, which is greater than 8 inches, I believe, is the cutoff between small and large. Typically, just from what I've seen, I mean, irrigation wells, and you probably know this too, are 16, 18 or more inches. So rather than and then there are reported kind of specific capacity or pump rates in different studies to get an idea of kind of, that gives you an idea of aquifer characteristics also. But really what we're using rather than that, rather than, because we don't have good data necessarily on pump capacities and what pumps are in these wells, really we're using the estimates of land use acreage, crop water use, and then estimates of crop water demand to estimate groundwater pumping. And that's what you'll see in the water budget.
I think it's ultimately what you suggest. I thought it was interesting how east or west of Pine Creek, how sandy that all is. So to see a big dark, you know, well count over there seems like they would be able to suck fast and furiously out of that area.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? I mean, you see wells are screened and located in areas that are productive with
water.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
But that's also probably the characteristics that make those wells productive also means that water is moving, you know, via recharge into those areas. Probably easily relative to other areas easily as well. So kind of two-way street there.
Thanks, Christina. Jim, I see your hand. Jim Brobeck.
Thank you. While we're on this slide number, let's see, slide number 26. And I want to remind presenters and commenters that there's our people that are joining by phone that are looking at the presentation materials with their on their computer. So it's nice for their sake to be able to let them know what slide we're on. So this is for slide number 26. We've got the number of wells, and I'm hoping that we can develop some idea of the depth of these wells, the screening locations of these wells, as well as the ones that are screened at multiple aquifer levels, because those are all really critical components of managing the groundwater. It's great to see where they're located and what size the casing is, but I would really like to know how deep they are. I'm under the impression that a lot of the wells that are being developed these days go below the alluvial layer into the lower layers that are a much more reliable source of water. So we need to be able to recognize where those are and manage for that. If we could go back to slide number 21.
This one?
Let's see. Yes, it's this one. It talks about how Butte Creek and Sacramento River are important recharge sources in the upper portions of the basin. Pumping may cause some mixture to deeper depths, and I imagine since it's associated with these two streams that you're talking about pulling a river or creek water directly into the aquifer, but by deeper depths, are you also talking about the deeper aquifers and the mixing of the alluvial aquifer water with the deeper aquifer as it leaks downward?
Yeah, so what that's referring to is, yeah, mixing happening at deeper depths, which means like, you know, well, this is down to 400 feet, but really caused by the dynamic of irrigation wells that can be screened, you know, over 100 or 200 feet of screening interval that essentially are creating connections between shallower aquifer zones and deeper aquifer zones. And so so much pumping and so many high density of wells in these areas that go down, you know, 200, 400, 600 feet and can be screened over long sections can also provide a conduit and kind of a way for water to move vertically. So that's kind of a whole nother piece of understanding vertical dynamics is there's not only kind of the geology and the hydrogeology that's creating vertical components, but also the well infrastructure itself can influence that.
Can we look at the other side of that? We're talking about the downward leakage. If you evacuate water from below and gravity pulls the water from the alluvial or the shallow aquifer down lower, can we also then take from that that if we're more cautious about tapping the lower aquifer, that it helps to support and keep intact the upper aquifer, that groundwater-dependent ecosystems as well as historic loser, users that don't have the 600-foot wells, that it's important to recognize the, I don't know if you call it leakage if it's going upstream. I prefer to think of it as like the foundation or the support system. If you can keep the lower system, now do we call it the piezometric or the... Well, you know what I'm talking about,
yeah,
the piezometric,
yeah,
or the potential metric, the pressurized. Yeah. If you keep the pressurized aquifer healthy, yeah, it helps support the overlying aquifers, right, that are so important to the historic users and the groundwater dependent ecosystem. So I would like to see that as the other side of the coin on this slide, that the lower aquifer actually supports the upper aquifer. So,
yeah. Yeah, and I think there's evidence for that in some of the multi-completion wells.
And if we could go to slide number 27. Mm-hmm. Getting there myself, let's see. Okay, and this shows a groundwater flow just in one layer. And DWR previously divided groundwater aquifers into either three or four zones in the Sacramento Valley. And I would like to see groundwater elevation maps for the different layers if DWR is still providing us with those. They used to get an accurate representation of the lateral and vertical groundwater flow levels. This is showing the lateral flow, but as per the discussion in the previous slide, there's also vertical flow both up and down. And I imagine it varies between layers, but it seems very important to understand, to look at it straight on so we can see if groundwater in some areas is flowing down or up. So we see the groundwater flow in that direction as well. It seems like a very important component in groundwater flow, and I'm hoping that DWR will be able to assist us in compiling the data so that we can identify these vertical flow patterns as well as the different lateral flow in the different layers, if it is different.
Yeah, and that gets at some of what I was saying, that Todd Green will be doing some of that work to really, I mean, to be able to do that, right, you have to have a monitoring network that allows for that. And so one of the first steps is to define what those zones should be. And like I said, there's been some kind of different definitions. And one of them, DWR has, standardized their change maps by shallow, intermediate, and deep. But that's not necessarily connected to geology and aquifer systems. And so first we want to define that better, and Todd Green is going to help us with that. And then we want to identify our monitoring wells, which of them kind of belong with which defined aquifer zone. So it may be that even like a multi-completion well, if it has four screens, it may be that two or three of those are actually in one, you know, in the defined upper zone, aquifer zone, and only the bottom one is in a different zone that we define, or different aquifer system, the lower Tuscan, or however we want to describe those accurately. And so then once we've done that, then we can say, okay, can we produce these, you know, a map for one zone versus another zone, or however we want to characterize that, or where are the data gaps? And I think we may find that we have some data gaps as well. So I think we are moving in the direction to do some of what you're talking about, which is good news.
Thank you, Christina.
Yeah. Oops, you're muted, Tanya.
Thank you. You're right. We're right on time, and I don't see any other hands. So I'd like for us to thank you, Christina. You can go ahead and, Byron, share your screen for this next 45-minute segment on historical water budget results, where you'll provide an overview of those results.
Great. Thank you, Tanya. Let me just pull that up.
And again, while you're pulling that up, just a reminder, after this next segment, we will also have another opportunity for some clarifying questions. Thank you, Byron. Go ahead.
Let's see. Can you see my screen okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As Tanya indicated, I'll talk a little bit about the historical water budgets, the draft water budget, essentially, that has been developed for the Vina Subbasin. And then we'll pause before talking about some of the assumptions for the current conditions and projected water budgets that will also be part of the groundwater sustainability plan. So building upon the hydrogeologic conceptual model, which, as Christina described, is sort of a representation of the physical characteristics of the system, we've developed water budgets to quantify the amounts of water moving through the system for the different water budget components over time in order to support the groundwater management planning under SGMA. And so this is really an accounting process, just like a bank account, where the deposits minus the withdrawals equal the change in the savings in the account. Similarly, the inflows to the basin minus the outflows from the basin are equivalent to the change in the amount of water stored within the basin over time. And the water budget, again, building upon the HCM, represents the different components of the system, including the land surface itself, so sort of from the top of the crop canopy, if you will, or the vegetation canopy, to the bottom of the root zone, as well as the surface water components, so the streams and canals within the system, and the groundwater system, the underlying aquifer system as well. And with the historical water budget, you know, one of the benefits of it is that it provides some insight into how the system has worked in the recent past. And we focused in on the period from 2000 to 2018 for purposes of GSP development. And it's built another model beyond the hydrogeologic conceptual model, which is the Butte Basin groundwater model. So this is an integrated hydrologic model or sort of a flow model that is performing these calculations for the different portions of the system over time. And over on the right in this figure, we just have a representation of the various components that are represented in the model, with the ones identified in red being, you know, mainly data inputs that we estimate independently and sort of feed to the model. And then the blue components that are more difficult to measure, things like recharge, as Christina talked about, and interbasin flows being quantities that we rely on the model to calculate for us. So the main components of the water budget, again, are these inflows to and outflows from the basin. We also break down the water budget between the land and surface water system and the groundwater system and account for exchanges between the two. And so this is a figure based on DWR's guidance document for water budget development under SGMA. It just basically shows those primary components. They end up being broken out in quite a bit more detail in the GSP. For example, surface water inflows would be divided out by source, whether they come from, you know, the State Water Project or the CDP or other sources or local sources, et cetera. But this is the basic structure of the water budget. And so we have our primary inflows to the basin, which include surface water inflows, precipitation, and the subsurface groundwater inflows. Our primary outflows, which include evapotranspiration or consumptive use, surface water outflows, subsurface groundwater outflows, and then in the case of the Vina Subbasin, what we call the net western boundary flows, and we'll talk about that in more detail, but that would be a combination of any gains in the Sacramento River from the groundwater system, as well as any interbasin flows with the Corning Subbasin. And then in terms of these exchanges between the land and surface water system and the groundwater system, we have the inflows to the land surface, which would be groundwater pumping, as well as gains in streams from the groundwater system, and then the recharge components, which would include stream losses or leakage, if you will, or seepage, as well as deep percolation, which would be the vertical movement of water downward through the root zone. And then also we quantify the change in storage, as mentioned, and that's primarily in the groundwater system. There's not a substantial change in storage in the root zone itself on an annual basis. So as you can imagine, many of the primary water budget drivers are land use, precipitation, evapotranspiration, surface water supplies, groundwater pumping, percolation or recharge, the surface water groundwater interactions, whether they're leakage or gains, and then the interbasin flows with the surrounding areas. So what I'll do is just kind of walk through these one by one to give you a sense of the estimates that we've developed for the Vina Subbasin itself. Here's a fairly busy figure that shows estimated land use over time. So within the model and the water budget, we have something like 20 different crop types broken out and so on. So this is sort of a summary of the general crop types, as well as the other land uses within the basin. The basin's about 185,000 acres in size, with roughly 45% agriculture, about 13% developed lands and 42% native lands. So it's about half agricultural lands and about half native lands, but also, of course, a significant area of development, particularly in the Chico area. The primary crops are rice, orchards being the dominant crop shown here in orange, and then other crops. So these would be non-rice, non-orchard crops. There's also some idle land from year to year, a small amount of wetlands, and then we have the developed lands and the native lands. I think one of the things to note here is that, you know, land use has been relatively stable over time. There have been some changes, somewhat of a increase in orchards, perhaps, somewhat less rice in recent years, but overall fairly stable conditions compared to some other areas of the Central Valley. Here's a look at precipitation over this 2000 to 2018 period. And we estimate these values by water year. And what we mean by that is from October 1st of the previous year to September 30th of the current water year. So for example, the water year 2000 would be from October 1st of 1999 to September 30th of 2000. I think one of the key takeaways here is that, you know, precipitation variability is substantial from year to year. And as we interpret the water budget results, I think that's important to keep in mind. It really does drive things like recharge and changes in groundwater storage, as we'll see in some of the later slides. So maybe keep this pattern in mind over this period where, you know, we see some pretty big swings in precipitation over time, totaling about 400,000 acre feet per year, or a little over 2 feet. So several of these figures break things down in terms of total acre feet. So the TAF stands for 1,000 acre feet, as well as in inches for those who think kind of in terms of inches of depth when looking at these types of numbers. So here's a similar slide that shows evapotranspiration estimates for the basin. And, you know, the primary consumptive use of water within the basin is from agriculture, even though it only makes up about 45% of the land area. It makes up about 70% of the consumptive use because of irrigation, essentially. Followed by native lands and then developed lands where there's less consumptive use because of the development, of course. And so the native evapotranspiration is going to be influenced strongly by precipitation from year to year because that's the, you know, the primary source of water. But we have a total estimate of ET or evapotranspiration of about 363,000 acre feet per year or a little bit under 2 feet. I guess one thing to note here also is just that, you know, evapotranspiration tends to be, when you look at it overall, less variable than precipitation because of irrigation. Here is a similar chart that shows the estimated water supplies historically within the basin. And as Christina alluded to, you know, the primary source of water is groundwater, making up about 92% between agriculture and urban uses, with some surface water diversions in certain areas. The total water supplies of about 263,000 acre feet per year, or about a foot and a half per acre, 18 inches per acre, roughly. One of the things we see here also is the variability in those estimated water supplies from year to year as influenced by precipitation and then the corresponding irrigation demands. So, for example, in a very dry winter, growers might start irrigating earlier in the season, or in a very hot summer, they may need to apply more water to irrigate their crops. And so we do see some variability in the estimated water supplies over time. Here is a figure that shows the estimated percolation amounts. So this is the vertical recharge through the root zone. And if you think back to the precipitation figure, you can see that it's quite similar. So that the average the annual recharge that occurs is really pretty strongly influenced by precipitation amounts in a given year, both due to natural recharge that occurs on native lands, but also due to recharge on agricultural and developed lands. And our total estimate of percolation averages about 200,000 acre feet per year, or about an acre foot per acre. So moving on to surface water groundwater interaction, this figure shows in orange the estimated stream losses, or again, you call it leakage or seepage, as well as the accretions in gray, so on the negative axis. So this is water that's coming from the groundwater system back to the streams in certain places and at certain times, as estimated using the model, as well as the canal and drain seepage in blue. So this would be seepage that occurs from essentially artificial conveyances of water within the basin. On net, we're estimating about 20,000 acre feet per year of recharge occurs through surface water groundwater interaction. And again, that's compared to about 200,000 acre feet per year of percolation, just to kind of give you a sense of magnitude. One of the things that the model allows us to do is to actually develop estimates of surface water groundwater interaction for individual streams that are simulated within the model. And so this figure shows an estimate of the average annual stream leakage for the different streams that traverse the Vina subbasin. And so the positive values, again, denote water moving from the streams into the groundwater system. And then the negative values for some of the creeks show a net gain to the stream flow from the groundwater system. And so seepage or leakage is greatest for Butte Creek, we think, followed by Big Chico Creek and Little Dry Creek, and then Rock Creek, Little Chico Creek, and Dry Creek. With other streams, smaller streams, actually showing a net gain in groundwater as estimated using the model. And again, whether or not a stream is gaining or losing water will depend quite a bit on where you're at in time and where you're at along the stream. So that'll be something probably to explore further as you start to think about stream depletions and your sustainable management criteria moving forward. Here's a look at the estimated interbasin flows, including groundwater inflows, subsurface inflows from the Foothill area to the east, and then the Butte, Los Molinos, and Wyandotte Creek subbasins. On average, we're estimating a net inflow of about 67,000 acre feet per year for these areas, but it varies depending on the basin, as Christina mentioned. And so we could take a look at that as well. So here's a look just on an annual basis, the estimated average net inflows for these subbasins, as well as the Foothill area to the east. On average, we're estimating inflows from the Foothill area of about 45,000 acre feet per year, so a fairly significant inflow to the basin, as well as 58,000 from the Los Molinos subbasin to the north of the county line, and net outflows to the Butte subbasin on the order of 40,000 acre feet per year. There is a small portion of the Vina subbasin boundary that that is shared with the Wyandotte Creek subbasin, but the interbasin flows are estimated to be quite small. I had also mentioned the western boundary. So I haven't talked about subsurface inflows with the Corning subbasin to the west. And part of the reason for that is that the model domain extends westward to the Sacramento River, but doesn't cover both sides. And so there are some challenges there in understanding the groundwater flows with the Corning Basin, either inflows or outflows, versus the exchanges with the Sacramento River. And so that's an item that, we think will need to be explored more moving forward, either through the next phase of GSP development or as part of the updates in the future. But it's somewhat uncertain at this time. Essentially, what we have done is to specify the groundwater levels along that boundary and use the model to estimate the flows along that boundary, be it surface water groundwater interaction or these subsurface interbasin flows. But there's a fair amount of uncertainty there that we want to acknowledge and expect that, you know, that's something that can be evaluated here moving forward, looking at some of the more regional models that DWR has developed, as well as the work that's being done in the Corning Subbasin, in this case in particular, with model development and water budget development. And the county is planning a project to basically conduct some of these evaluations or collaborate with the neighboring areas to help understand the exchanges between the neighboring basins. When we combine these subsurface flows and surface water groundwater interaction along that western boundary, our current estimates suggest actually a net outflow, which is why this figure shows the values as being negative, of about 56,000 acre feet per year. And Christina presented the groundwater level contour map that showed the flow direction arrows. I think it's important to recognize that based on that map, it doesn't show really large gradients along that boundary or very apparent gradients. So it may be that these flows along that boundary are more related to surface water groundwater interaction with the Sacramento Basin or Sacramento River, excuse me, than subsurface flows to the Corning Subbasin. So that kind of covers the primary components of the water budget, and hopefully gives a sense of what the estimates are at this point and how they change over time. This figure rolls up the results for the water budget kind of consistently with that initial figure that showed the various flow paths or components, with the land and surface water system shown on the left and the groundwater system shown on the right. And then for each graph, we have a series of stacked bars, on the left being inflows in each chart and on the right being outflows. And so primary inflows to the Vina Subbasin are surface water inflows through the streams that traverse the basin, followed by precipitation and groundwater pumping, with a small component of stream accretions, basically shown here. It's barely discernible in the figure. On the right side of the figure, to the left, are the outflows, which are dominated by surface water outflows, followed by evapotranspiration, so consumptive use actually leaving the system and returning to the atmosphere, deep percolation, and then stream losses. Looking at the groundwater system, so starting at the bottom of the root zone, if you will, and then moving down to the base of fresh water in the aquifer system, we have primary inflows of deep percolation, so basically recharge through the root zone, either from precipitation or irrigation, followed by subsurface inflows from these neighboring basins or the foothill area, and then stream losses, so basically leakage from streams that's coming back into the groundwater system. Over on the right, we have the primary outflows being groundwater pumping, followed by subsurface outflows to neighboring basins, and then these outflows along the western boundary. The dark blue on the inflow side here is actually water coming out of the aquifer system as a change in storage. So over the 2000 to 2018 water year period, our estimate of the average change in storage on an annual basis within the Vina Subbasin is about 20,000 acre feet per year of decrease in storage. Here is just another way to look at the groundwater budget. where we have a series of stacked bars corresponding to each year. And so the positive values represent inflows to the groundwater system, and the negative values represent outflows. The dark black line is an estimate of the cumulative change in storage over time. So I mentioned the 20,000 acre feet per year decrease in storage. Over this 19-year period, we can see the cumulative change in storage is close to negative 400,000 acre feet. So that's the 20,000 acre feet per year. This gives a sense of the variability in both the inflows to and outflows from the basin over time, but also the variability and change in storage over time. And then in the axis, we've also annotated the different year types. So we have wet years shown as a W, above normal years shown as AN, below normal shown as BN, dry shown as D, and C shown as critical. So this kind of gives a sense of how these changes in storage and water budget components vary over time, depending on the hydrologic year type. And that's based on the Sacramento Valley Water Year Index that DWR has developed. Another way to look at the results is to look at the groundwater pumping over time as it relates to the cumulative change in storage. And so this figure basically peels out that information from the water budget, with the bars showing the estimated annual groundwater pumping, color-coded based on year type, with wet years shown in blue, red years shown critical years shown in red, et cetera. Along with this change in storage. So we can see over the historical water budget period that we've looked at, generally this decline in groundwater in storage, but there is correlation of those changes in storage to the year type. So in the wetter years, we tend to see recovery. In the critical years, we tend to see declines. There's also some correlation to the groundwater demands over time, of the groundwater demands over time to the hydrologic year type, where the wetter years, the demands are less, and the critical years, they're more. I think one thing to keep in mind over this historical period, though, and we'll kind of see this as we get into the current conditions and projected water budgets later on, the decline in storage we've seen over this period is likely largely due to drought conditions, and maybe less so due to changes in land use or other increases in groundwater demand that have occurred. So just to kind of wrap up this portion of the presentation, some of the main takeaways from the historical water budget are that land use has been relatively consistent over time. There is a strong reliance on groundwater in the Vinah subbasin. Precipitation and recharge are highly variable from year to year, which I think is important to keep in mind. Indications of decreased stream accretions and increased interbasin flows over time have occurred. There is a strong need to better understand the flows along the western boundary, exchanges with the Sacramento River. And that reductions in storage appear to be more related to recent historic drought than increased groundwater pumping. We don't see a super strong correlation there, although there is some. So I think that's all I had for this section. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions or provide any clarifications.
Thank you, Byron. Again, if you have a question, please go ahead and raise your hand. Or you can also use the chat box if you'd prefer to write in your question. And you can find the chat on your main toolbar. And before I go to the hands raised, I'm just going to check in with anyone who may be on the phone to see if you have questions, since you are at a disadvantage when you're on the phone. So anyone who's on the phone, you can go ahead and unmute yourself using star six. And I'll just wait a moment to see if you have any questions. Anyone on the phone? Hearing none. Jim Brobeck, I see that your hand is raised.
Yes, thank you. Byron, could you go to slide number 5? It shows the land use.
Sure. Just bear with me here for a second. Here we go.
There it is. The bar graph doesn't seem that significant, but when I see the increase in orchards over the between 2000 and 18, I notice a 4,000 acre increase, and of course that doesn't account for whatever's happened in the past couple of years. And I see an almost one for one, not exactly, it's like 3 to 4 decrease in surface water irrigated rice. And when I put those two things together, you get about 7,000 acres of land that in one case had surface water diverted onto it, I assume for rice primarily, and the increase in groundwater pumping. So the demand has gone up, and the potential for recharge from irrigation has gone down. And I think it's really significant to keep track of this and to keep it updated. I'm hoping to get some more updated as we move through the process to see if there has been an increase. When I talk to some vegetable growers at the market that are located north of town, they tell me they're kind of alarmed at seeing the new orchards going in. So I think it's really important to not downplay the shift in land use to irrigate it to groundwater dependent. Slide number 7. You've got what I suppose is mostly the urban and suburban landscape being the developed. And at least in Chico, there's a lot of acres of trees that are not in the riparian zone, but that are groundwater dependent. So I'm wondering how you're accounting for that in evapotranspiration. If you're counting and valuing the importance of groundwater and evapotranspiration in the urban forest, the groundwater dependent urban forest, where does that fall in this graph?
Sure. So you're correct that the kind of the suburban areas are included in that developed land use estimate also. And so what we've done to estimate the evapotranspiration is to use satellite imagery to estimate water use coefficients for the urban area, with the goal of accounting for all of the consumptive use that occurs in the urban area. And so we apply those water use coefficients over time, using reference evapotranspiration data from an agronomic weather station.
Does that include the unirrigated street trees and other vegetation, whether it be native or non-native, that's no longer being irrigated? Is that being accounted for in evapotranspiration?
Yes, that would be included.
So is the urban forest count as native or urban?
We have utilized DWR's land and water use surveys to classify the land use. And so to the extent that those are identified as developed areas, they would be included as part of the developed lands. The land use surveys don't typically, subdivide things out at perhaps the scale necessary to separate the developed areas into sort of paved areas or buildings versus landscape.
Okay, I think I hear what you're saying. Let's see, number 6 and number 9. One of them has to do with percolation, and I think one of them has to do with inflow. Precipitation, and the other one I think is percolation. And I'm wondering what these give a 1,000 acre feet. And I'm wondering what area you're measuring, what are the boundaries of the area that are measuring, especially on the eastern side, that's so important for the deep aquifer?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, yeah, that's a really good question. So the Butte Basin groundwater model performs calculations of precipitation, or well, the input data is aligned with the model elements, and the percolation is calculated for those elements as well. And so there's a fairly spatially rich data set. If you look at the figure in this slide, you can kind of see the lattice of model elements. And I don't know off the top of my head what the size of those is. I think it's maybe a few hundred acres on average. And so the calculations are done uniquely for each element based on the estimated land use for that element, estimated precipitation, estimated soil characteristics, et cetera. So there is kind of a spatially distributed output from the model that then we've aggregated to the sub-basin scale for purposes of reporting out for sigma.
Okay, does that answer your question? No, I don't see what the boundary is on the eastern side. I'm wondering how far up into the watershed your data is being compiled from.
I see. I would probably have to go back. We'd probably have to go back to one of Christina's slides.
I don't know if I have a map either of. Land use one might show it.
Her slides. That's the boundary right there, Christina.
No, this is just the boundary of the sub-basin. It actually extends up several miles into the foothills to the, I guess maybe Christina, you could help answer this question, but I believe the model domain or the boundary was extended at some point in the past to bring in these foothill areas.
So it was, but the numbers, the precipitation and percolation numbers you're reporting is for the sub-basin area, right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, so it's for the sub-basin area, which is what you see. All of a sudden my screen changed here, but that's right. The Butte Basin groundwater model extends further up into the foothills and goes just about as far east as Paradise. I think Paradise is right along the boundary, essentially, so if you can kind of visualize that, that's how then the water budget numbers have a foothill inflow, kind of a subsurface number from the foothills. It's because the model boundaries is further east than the subbasin boundary.
Okay, then for some reason the modelers decided just to cut off the percolation and the precipitation data. Maybe, for instance, where the pine trees start. Where the chaparral stops and the pine trees start. It seems somewhat subjective since we don't really know how the lower aquifer is charged, knowing that there are really deep wells up in the far northeastern portion of Butte County that are up in the mountain region that, according to well drillers, are also hitting the Tuscan Formation. And so where's that being recharged and what's the connectivity with that, with the basin? All these things are still as yet to be determined as we come up with where the water's coming from, how much water's flowing into it, and how fast it's moving and all that.
Well, I think that's where the stable isotope recharge study actually gave us some insights on that. If recharge was moving into the aquifer system at depth from the high elevation area by deep percolation and then subsurface flow, mm-hmm. we would have expected to see high elevation water deep in the aquifer. And we didn't. We only saw high elevation water in the shallower zones. Granted, down to like 400 feet was one of the monitoring wells that we saw that characteristic in the Butte Creek, kind of further north where Butte Creek and the Sac River are coming into the valley. So that really suggested to us that high elevation water, to the extent that it is brought into the valley by the surface water system, then it moves into the groundwater system. But there wasn't evidence that it's moving subsurface from high elevation into the deepest portions of the Valley groundwater system.
Oh, okay.
Which was helpful because we knew that that question was out there. And I think the Stable Isotopes helped clarify that process a little bit.
Yeah, and of course the mountain region does have some pretty deep cut topography. So the elevation really changes radically. There's some really steep terrain up there, both Big Chico Creek and Butte Creek and the other creeks up there.
Right.
Slide number 11, this is one that the last time I saw it, I just didn't get it, that Mud Creek and Pine Creek.
I'm sorry.
Groundwater. Slide number 11 on Byron's presentation, it shows Mud Creek and Pine Creek actually as gaining.
Jim, can you hear me?
Jim? I can hear you. Yeah, can you hear me?
Well, you're really breaking up. There's a lot of distortion in your audio.
Oh, yeah, you too. You know, I got bumped off. My whole screen went black. I was gone for about 10 minutes, and I hope I'm not getting kicked off again.
Okay, I would suggest that maybe, because it's really hard to hear you, that maybe you type questions in the chat. Because I think we've lost you there. Okay, well, we've lost you, Jim. So you can, if you can hear me, go ahead and type in the chat. Let me check in to see if anyone else has any other questions that you'd like to ask Byron about this segment that he just presented on. Yes, Richard Harriman?
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Good afternoon, Byron. Richard Harriman with one short question. As part of your database, did you also look at permits granted through the State Water Resources Control Board? In other words, as far as surface water, was any of that documentation used in part of your database, if it's there, for example, ownership of surface water rights?
I think the answer is yes, if I understand the question correctly, Mr. Harriman. So in terms of estimating the surface water use historically, we relied in part on the Electric Water Rights Information Management System maintained by the State Board, where diverters report annually their surface water use by water rights permit.
Is that documented in your report, or will it be attached as an appendix or something like that, so we'll have it in the record for the GSA?
Yes, I mean, I think we will. Right, we will document the estimates of surface water supplies in the model report. So maybe not in the water budget chapter itself, but in the associated documentation describing model development. I don't know that we would, you know, actually attach every water rights report that we looked at, but rather, you know, just describe the source of the data for the different diversions.
So just to complete the query, so it won't be listed as an ownership. I don't know how many permits there are that were issued that would provide surface water either coming in or going out, but you're not going to include the names or the amounts?
Probably not. I think that, you know, the primary surface water users in the basin are probably Rancho Escuan. Mm-hmm. I would need to review that. I think there may be some other small diversions that we've estimated as well. I mean, generally speaking, that type of information has not been available historically in a readily usable manner. So in some cases, we've estimated surface water use as well, where we know there are diversions, but don't necessarily have the actual data from the State Board.
The reason for
You're on mute, Richard. You're on mute.
Thank you. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I would respectfully suggest that it might be useful to include that, because to the extent we're going to be analyzing the sustainability, as if there is a differential between the permits that have been issued within the jurisdiction, Butte County in general, but the GSAs in particular, then there are, I'll put it this way, legally, there are dangling water rights out there that can be invoked or used, which may not be documented. I would ask that you consider doing that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Any final questions before we take a 15-minute break? One note about the break, I encourage you to stay logged into Zoom and just put yourself on mute and turn off your video instead of having to log back on. But before we do that, any other questions in the last couple minutes we have before going to break? Seeing none, let me just check in with people on the phone. Anyone on the phone, you can take yourself off mute if you have any questions that you'd like to ask Byron or Christina. Okay, hearing none, let's take a 15-minute break, and we'll restart right at 3 o'clock sharp. Just go ahead and put yourselves on mute and stop your video, and then we'll see you again right at 3. Thank you.
during that process and some of the draft results there as well. So in developing the current and projected water budget scenarios, there are several assumptions embedded, as you can imagine, looking at different factors that could affect the water budgets and the groundwater conditions over time. And so just to summarize, and we'll go through these in greater detail, for the current conditions water budget, we're looking at a long-term hydrology data set, so historical precipitation, evapotranspiration, and stream flows, and combining that with the most recently available land use information. And in that case, we have data sets for 2015 and 2016 that cover the basin and are able to use. And so what we've done there is to map that current snapshot of land use, or again, the most recent recently available information, to different year types, basically a normal year type for 2016, using 2016, and for extreme dry years using 2015 to reflect changes in particular in cropping that may occur in the Vina subbasin depending on water availability. And to identify those year types, we look at Lake Oroville inflows, and particularly the April to July inflows, as a surrogate for surface water availability in the Vina subbasin, recognizing that the changes in hydrology that would affect the Feather River Basin would likely result in similar changes in hydrology in the inflows to the Vina subbasin. So that provides us a good base based on kind of what conditions are now to evaluate variability in the water budget over a series of wet and dry years, looking at this longer term hydrology. And the GSP regulations require looking at 50 years of hydrology to develop these water budgets. And so what we've done is to use the full model simulation period, again referring to the Butte Basin groundwater model, which is from 1971 to 2018. And that's a 48-year period, and then we repeat the years 2004 and 2005, which were relatively normal years hydrologically, to provide that full 50 years of record. Building upon that, we have developed the projected water budget scenarios as well. And so in order to look at projected future conditions or possible future conditions, we've developed three additional scenarios. One that looks at plan development based on the 2030 general plan without climate change. And then we've looked at two climate change scenarios using data sets provided by DWR centered around 2030, so sort of a near-term potential climate change scenario, and then out at 2070, so approximately 50 years into the future. So what I'll do is just kind of walk through some of the information embedded in these different assumptions and these data sets. This figure shows the Sacramento Valley Water Year Index over time. We've seen some earlier figures that have this color coding. And so the blue values represent wet years, with the red values representing critical years. And then we have above normal, below normal, and dry years in between. Looking at the full period of record for the Sacramento Valley Index, which began in 1906, we have an average value of about 8.1, and that's based on basically unimpaired flows in the Sacramento River Basin, as compared to this 50-year period that we're looking at with an average of 8.0, so fairly representative of long-term hydrology. Also looking at precipitation over this 1906 to 2018 period, we have an average value of about 25 inches versus about 26 inches over this more recent 50-year period. And so one of the things to note in this graph is that the hydrologic period that's been evaluated for the current conditions and projected water budgets includes periods, relatively wet periods and relatively dry periods. So we have the relatively wet period in the early 1970s, followed by another wet period in the early 80s, and then the late 90s. And then we have drought periods as well, such as the 76-77 drought period, drought of the early 1990s, and then the more recent drought period starting in about 2007. Um, So the other, or another component of these scenarios is to look at land use under current conditions, and again under future conditions, based on the 2030 general plan. And so the primary change in the Vina Subbasin is that there is a fair amount of fair development, planned development, excuse me, in the Chico area, as shown in this figure in gray. So the on the right, we have the estimated future conditions based on the general plan and the parcel zoning. And on the left, we have the current conditions circa 2016. And, you know, based on the land use planning that's occurred, what we see is primarily a shift that increased development would offset native lands up along the eastern boundary of the basin, with very little decrease in agricultural lands expected. Looking at climate change, I had mentioned that the climate change data sets that DWR has provided, and these are provided to support GSAs in developing their groundwater sustainability plans. And there are four scenarios available. They're centered around 2030 and 2070. So we have one 2030 central tendency scenario. So what that means is that DWR has selected several climate change models that they feel are appropriate for use in California, in the Central Valley, and then basically average the results to develop what's called a central tendency climate change data set. We also have a similar data set for 2070. In addition to those two scenarios, DWR has provided two more extreme climate change scenarios based on some of these climate models. One being 2070, a drier scenario with extreme warming, and another being centered around 2070, a wetter scenario with moderate warming. And so those are used as part of scenario development to modify the historical hydrology and surface water supplies. And so the scenarios that we've selected are the central tendency scenarios. Those are by and large the scenarios that have been used in other basins, and in a sense represent the most probable climate change that will occur in the future based on our current understanding. And so over on the right are just a list of other basins and the climate change scenarios that have been selected there. The only basin that I'm aware of that is looking at the extremer scenarios is the Yolo Subbasin. So just to provide a little bit more background on the climate change effects that are projected for these different scenarios, I've got a couple figures here. On the left, one showing average annual precipitation, and on the right showing reference evapotranspiration. And so interestingly, and perhaps counterintuitively, each of these scenarios actually projects a slight increase in precipitation around the 2030 and 2070 periods, with the wetter, warmer scenario showing a more marked increase. One area where the scenarios also agree is that due to increasing temperature in the future, there is a projected increase in evapotranspiration and consumptive use under each of the scenarios, with a more extreme increase under the drier scenario with extreme warming. Here's a look at how the central tendency scenarios are projected to affect stream inflows to the basin. And so in the upper left, we have a figure that shows the average annual inflows for some of the primary creeks. And then we have figures for each of some of these primary creeks that show average annual inflows on a monthly basis under each scenario. So the blue bars in each figure represent the current conditions, whereas the orange represent the 2030 central tendency and the 2070 central tendency. And what we see is that although there's an overall increase in precipitation, you know, the effect on monthly flows actually differs and really depends on the month. So there's generally a shift in precipitation from the late fall and early spring more towards those winter months. And that you can see that in the graphs here, but the corresponding decrease in stream flows in many cases in the spring months between April and June. So that's, I think, something to consider, particularly moving forward, looking at stream depletions, and to consider just given that the timing and the location of these flows is important for environmental and other reasons. So looking at some of the results of these different scenarios, again, this slide just kind of summarizes the different assumptions used to develop the scenarios in terms of land use, urban demands, diversions, and hydrology. And I won't spend a lot of time here, except to say that in particular, for the urban demands, we are using the 2016 to 2018 period. So this is following the historic drought that ended around 2015, where we've actually seen a decrease in per capita water use, particularly in the Chico area. Whereas in the 2050 scenarios, we're looking out further in the future and have developed our estimates of urban water use based on draft estimates provided by Cal Water that they're developing as part of their urban water management plan update to be completed next year. So what are some of the changes in some of the components that drive the water budget under these different scenarios? In general, we anticipate about the same agricultural land as mentioned previously under each scenario, with a decrease in native lands and a corresponding increase in developed lands, again, based on the general plan. Here is a set of figures that shows some of the changes in hydrology and demands. For each component here, I've got a graph that shows the annual volume and then a graph that shows the annual value expressed in inches. Again, just for those who kind of think more in terms of inches. In terms of precipitation, as mentioned, we expect to see, or at least the data sets suggest, an increase in overall precipitation over time. Also an increase in evapotranspiration over time as temperature increases. Similar agricultural supplies, somewhat less surface water availability under the climate change scenarios, particularly because of the projected decrease in the April to July surface water inflows to the basin. And then kind of referring back to the earlier table that we looked at, looking at the urban demands, we actually see a decrease in urban demands from historical compared, or from the current conditions as compared to the longer historical period because of some of the changes in conservation that occurred post-drought. But then an increase back to similar levels under the future condition scenarios, primarily due to population growth as opposed to increases in per capita water use. Here's a look at deep percolation for these different water budget scenarios. For agricultural lands in the upper left, developed lands in the upper right, and then native lands in the lower left. Similar to the increase in precipitation, we see an increase in deep percolation for the agricultural lands. Also somewhat of an increase for the urban lands and the native lands in terms of volume, primarily because of that shift of land use from native lands to urban lands. We do see somewhat less, or we estimate less percolation from the urban lands just due to paved surfaces that are out there, as well as roofs and the potential for greater runoff to occur. So urban deep percolation is estimated to be around 8 inches per year as opposed to about 12 inches for native. We do see some estimates of changes in interbasin flows with basically compared to historical potential increase in flows from the Los Molinos subbasin. as well as potentially an increase from the Foothill area. And then we see, we estimate somewhat of an increase compared to historical along the western boundary for those flows, but somewhat of a decrease over time. That's really heavily dependent on assumptions about how water levels may change along that boundary and in adjacent sub-basins. We also see somewhat of a decrease in net outflows to the Butte sub-basin. Here's a look at stream leakage for some of the primary streams, expressed both in acre feet per year and in CFS, so average cubic feet per second. Fairly similar conditions across the different scenarios that were looked at, but somewhat of an increase in leakage compared to the historical time period that was evaluated. Here are a couple of tables that just summarize the different scenario results for the current conditions and the projected water budgets. And so we have on at the top of the slide, a table showing estimated water budget components in thousands of acre feet per year for the land and surface water system. So this would be the root zone and surface water bodies within the basin. And then on the bottom for the groundwater system. Some of the things to note are that overall, because of the projected increase in precipitation, we tend to see a projected increase in surface water inflows to the basin over time. We see somewhat of an increase in groundwater pumping over time, which would result, I think, in large part due to the increases in evapotranspiration as temperature may rise and crop water demands may increase. Fairly similar recharge from deep percolation. Looking at the groundwater system, somewhat similar stream losses and gains or accretions across the different scenarios. And compared to the average annual decrease in storage of 20,000 acre feet that we estimated for the 2000 to 2018 period, which was marked by fairly extreme and historic drought, we see more balanced conditions in the water budget for these different scenarios, ranging from a decrease of about 1,000 acre feet per year on average to about 3,000 acre feet per year. This figure shows the cumulative change in groundwater storage that's estimated for each of the scenarios, with the blue line showing the current conditions, the orange line showing the future conditions without climate change, the gray line showing the future conditions with climate change centered around 2030, and the yellow line showing future conditions with climate change centered around 2070. I think one of the key takeaways here is that we don't see hugely different estimates of the cumulative change in storage between the scenarios as compared to changes from year to year or over periods, over relatively wet or dry periods. So along the x-axis here, we have each year of the scenario from 1 to 50 and the associated year that was mapped to it in terms of the hydrology from 1971 to 2018. With 2004 and 2005 repeated at the end to provide a full 50-year period. And then also a notation for the water year type to help provide some insight into how we might interpret this figure. And so as you might expect, as we go from the current conditions and start to layer in potential future development, and then climate change, overall a greater decrease in storage over this full 50-year period. But again, the variability over time as influenced by precipitation patterns is really quite a bit greater. I guess one thing to maybe look at here is just we have a cumulative increase in storage over this period of up to 300,000 acre feet. But then over a dry, relatively dry period, declines of, you know, up to a couple hundred thousand acre feet or 300,000 acre feet as well. So fairly big swings in the amount of groundwater and storage. So some of the takeaways, I think I've hit on these, but that increased urbanization in the Vina Chico management area will replace undeveloped lands primarily with a limited reduction to agriculture. Climate change may result in an overall increase in precipitation and ET demands. So those are sort of counteractive or kind of to some extent counteract each other, but also the timing of the precipitation will be quite an important consideration also. An overall increase in surface water inflows with a shift from the spring to the winter months because of those changes in precipitation patterns, as well as runoff from those watersheds that have some snow accumulation. We see a modest increase in net stream losses compared to the historical period, but again, it'll be important to consider the timing within and across years, particularly when evaluating sustainable management criteria. There's a slight increase in the projected inflows from the Los Salinas subbasin and the Foothill area, but also an increase in outflows to the Butte subbasin and potentially along the western boundary to the Sacramento River as stream gains and or interbasin flows to the Corning subbasin. Again, kind of looking back to the cumulative storage figure, there's a variability in groundwater storage from the peak to the low that's projected of up to 600 or 700,000 acre feet from sort of the wettest period to the driest period over the 50-year planning horizon, and similar conditions across scenarios. The projections do suggest, again, a modest reduction in the average annual groundwater storage of around between 1,000 and 3,000 acre feet per year, depending on scenarios. One takeaway there is that even though those projected changes are small, there may be a need for projects and management actions to avoid undesirable results and consideration when developing those. For example, if you were to develop a project to capture winter flows in wet years for recharge, but you're only able to implement it once every few years, then you would want to consider sizing the project to help you bridge the gap in the drier years. So additional takeaways. Groundwater storage is largely driven by drought cycles. And so drought planning will be important to prevent undesirable results and consideration of how those groundwater conditions might vary over a series of dry years versus a series of wet years. Climate change may affect stream flows more than groundwater pumping, particularly during the critical periods for environmental uses. So I think the message there is that changes in precipitation patterns may somewhat mask any impact that additional pumping would have on stream losses in certain areas. Kind of getting back to the point about reductions in storage, even though they appear to be relatively small, they would accumulate over time under these projected scenarios. And so that will be something to consider when looking at projects and management actions, as well as setting your sustainable management criteria, the thresholds based upon which you will determine whether undesirable results are occurring. A key to implementing SGMA will be monitoring. The water budgets give us a good, understanding of how the system has worked in the past and how it may respond in the future. But a key to successful implementation of SGMA will be appropriate and adequate monitoring to better understand how these changes translate into groundwater conditions. So with that, I'll pause and be happy to try to address any questions or comments.
Thank you, Byron. Okay, I'm going to check in with people who are on the phone first to see if anyone has any questions, and I'll just wait a moment because I know it can take a while to get off of mute. Anyone on the phone have any questions? Okay, and I see that there are a couple hands up. Please do raise your hand or go ahead and open up the chat box, and you can type your question in the chat box as well, and I can read those. Richard, let's go to you, Richard Harriman.
Byron, I just have to say that your presentation is so detailed and thorough. I really appreciate it. I wanted to ask something else in the light of the fact that there have been some discussions about bringing surface water from out of the basin, specifically from the Feather River through the Paradise Irrigation District intertie. I don't see any reference in this baseline document to using those sources. And if there we're going to have a groundwater sustainability plan that contemplates that, are those sources factored in as potential sources for recharge in the Vina subbasin anywhere in the study?
Not at this point in time. The water budgets that have been developed are really meant to help tee that up and help support that type of evaluation moving forward as you look at projects and management actions. But they really are kind of baselines that, you know, that do not make any assumptions about exactly what those projects might be. That would be, you know, something that would be evaluated here moving forward.
Would that include I'm trying to figure out how we get the chicken before the egg, or the egg before the chicken. When is that going to be brought in? I mean, how will we know what those sources are and how they're going to play? I'm trying to understand the sequence of events.
I can weigh in on this, I think. So right now, these scenarios don't include really any potential future policy. So the scenarios are climate change, you know, effects, and then the future conditions are based on current general plan policy. So as we move forward into GSP completion and start talking about sustainable management criteria, we'll also be talking about projects and management actions in that piece of the GSP. And so I think one thing that might happen is we start to, as we already kind of have been, start to accumulate a list of all the different possible projects out there, from recharge to new water supplies to conservation. And then that becomes a policy conversation about, okay, which ones or package of these do we want further evaluation on in terms of water budget work and modeling and that kind of thing. Does that answer your question?
Christina, yes, it does. And I'm wondering, I thought Paul might be present at this. I couldn't tell whether he's there. But then would we also include the climate impacts in the PID sustainability study that's being done down in Sacramento? What I'm thinking is, I don't see climate change relative to the surface water sources in the Feather River or Sacramento in this study. So that would seem to me we'd have to be doing a climate change analysis at a latter point for the GSP projects. Is that what you're contemplating, then, a different time for climate change analysis?
Actually, Byron, you want to address that? Feather River is included in this, right, to some degree?
That's correct. And the climate change data sets that DWR has provided do include data from a model called CalSim that helps simulate and understand how state water project operations might change over time. So for example, looking at the Table A water, I think that that those data sets would support that type of evaluation as to how the availability of the Feather River water that could be utilized in the Vina Subbasin might change in the future.
And the PID water would be in potentially inflows to the lake, right? And potentially Butte Creek water. And both of those have been kind of included in this work, right? With some evaluation of climate change effects?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
It would help, if I could make a suggestion, I just can't compliment you enough, Byron, but in terms of making the record and tracking it, it would really be helpful if perhaps that could be a footnote. And since this is a draft presentation, and I'm addressing this to you and to Christina, that in terms of keeping track of this, capturing this information, it would be really useful to have it as a footnote in your study. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. We do have, I'm going to just lower your hand there. We have a question in the chat from Jean Moran. What is the total groundwater storage volume and TAF, trying to get an idea of the percent change in storage for the predicated changes in acre feet per year, TAF per year?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. We've actually just been looking into that recently and using the model to estimate the amount of freshwater in storage in the different subbasins within Butte County. And for the Vina Subbasin, the estimated freshwater in storage is about 16 million acre feet.
Yep.
Okay. Okay, Jean, let us know if you have a follow-up. In the meantime, I'd like to move on to Amy. I see your hand is up. Amy Raymond.
I had a question at slide 22, which was looking at the the Sacramento Valley index. So in your bullet, you're showing calculating an average against that, and utilizing an average assumes a normal distribution, and I'm just not seeing enough points on the upper side of that line to feel good that that's a normal distribution. So I'd suggest maybe a median analysis on that.
Okay, yeah, that can be easily done.
I guess I was also thinking if you'd done kind of a robustness analysis, if how far off these numbers could be in your input estimates, that you went through in slide 22, 23, 24, which ones, and how they would affect your ultimate model.
We haven't done
potential errors in the model, if you noise up some of your assumptions.
Yes, I mean, yeah, one thing we know for sure is that there are errors in the model, and it's always subject to uncertainty. We haven't done a really detailed sensitivity analysis at this point in time, but hope that through developing these different scenarios, we get sort of a sense of the range of how the conditions might change over time. The model is a tool, hopefully a useful tool, to help support the GSP development and implementation process. But it's, I think, as you point out, always really important to consider the uncertainties and try to understand where they are in the model.
Yeah, or which ones are play the biggest role in changing things. My other question is, this is normalized kind of over the entire basin area. we've seen in the geology and the conditions, would you look to do this within kind of the sub areas of the basement, the geological sub areas, so that you're not, or we're just, you're averaging. I guess we'd have big drawdowns in certain areas, and other areas are going to be more positive in what the impact.
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, one of the values of the tool is that it does allow, you know, to drill down to that higher level of detail to understand, you know, what the changes in groundwater conditions might be in different locations within the basin. At this point in time, for the purposes of the GSP, we've been focusing on the basin-wide water budget, recognizing that, you know, that there will be a need to look more closely, for example, or in particular, as you develop thresholds for individual monitoring wells, you know, to consider conditions in those different locations.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Amy. We do have a bit of a queue right now. There are a few questions in the chat box. I'll get to you in a moment. I see you've had your hand up for quite a while. Jim Brobeck?
Hi, I hope I'm clear now. You're clear.
Yes.
Good. Byron, the rather alarming decline in groundwater storage, is that those figures are modeling figures? Are they borne out by any of the monitoring that we've done?
You're correct, Mr. Brobeck. So these are estimates developed by the model for the basin as a whole. And the, you know, the way these are borne out by the monitoring data is through the calibration process for the model, where we have compared the groundwater levels at specific locations to historical observed groundwater levels, and use that as a basis for calibrating the model to give us some confidence that it's reasonably estimating these storage changes over the basin as a whole.
I see.
And I would say we do see, just to add to that, we do see kind of this pattern in our groundwater level monitoring hydrographs. So, you know, we see consistency there between what the model is estimating volume wise and what changes in groundwater levels there are.
Well, that is a great concern, of course. So many of the SGMA strategies that I've seen and that I've heard even in these discussions is focused on increasing supply and allowing groundwater declines to be remediated by hoped-for wet year recharge projects rather than by conservation. I notice in the future climate change scenarios that are presented, there hasn't been a discussion of what's commonly known as mega droughts or paleoclimatologically defined droughts. Climate over California during the last 150 years has been pretty stable when examined in the context of the past 2,000 years, but paleoclimate records indicate that multi-decade droughts are not at all out of the range of natural variability, and that the warmer temperatures associated with global warming might exacerbate these conditions. Over the past 20 years, we've had three stretches of short-term drought, but there's been at least four major multi-decade droughts well-documented over the past 1,200 years in the American West. I just saw a quote by Professor Jay Lund. He said, "We got through the last short-term drought by pulling extra water out of the ground, but if you get into a real mega drought, that groundwater will be gone for 90% of the time that the mega drought lasts." I wonder, are we going to be doing any analysis of what happens with multi-decade droughts that's exacerbated by climate change?
Paul, might you want to take this?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi. And actually, I was going to turn it to Byron, too, because the methodology for doing this is kind of laid out in the GSP regs, but this is something that, you know, on slide 35, the severe droughts that we've experienced are really going to drive the discussion at the next phase on sustainable management criteria. But that uncertainty about the mega droughts, and we've been, I think this past 20 years it was reported, this was like the third worst drought period in the past couple hundred years. So it's something I think when we get to the SHAC and up to the GSA, BINA GSA board, discussing how we're going to take the uncertainties and put plans in place, this is definitely going to be part of that discussion for the future. But that's a management call that we'll have to discuss with the SHAC and the BINA GSA board.
Right, the management and the strategies are different if you're trying to maintain groundwater levels rather than remediate groundwater levels. And so that's why I ask it. Most of the remediation strategies require that we stay within this relatively stable climate that we've had in the past 150 years that is actually outside of the range of the full range of natural variability. So as a precautionary measure, it's something that I want to make sure that we consider. And thanks for bringing that up, Paul. I appreciate that.
No, this will be a big discussion coming up this next phase.
Very good. Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you, Jim. There are some questions in the chat. Anne Dawson, also on the Shack, says, I'm struggling to reconcile the dramatic drop in the groundwater storage from 20 to 1,000 acre feet. Would you please go through the numbers that contribute most to this difference?
Let's see if I can. I mean, you kind of have to dig into some of the, you know, the individual components of the water budget. I think, you know, a lot of the reason is that this 2000 to 2018 period was relatively dry. Another reason is that because of the interconnectedness of surface water and groundwater in the Sacramento Valley, over the long term, I believe that the system somewhat responds to changes in stresses, if you will, pumping and recharge through changes in surface water groundwater interaction, which help explain that.
Byron, can I jump in real quick too and just point out that those averages are over two different time periods. So, right, so if you go to slide 35, the next slide, I think looking at the change in storage, the 20,000 acre feet is for the 2000 to 2018 time period. So you're averaging that second, only the second half of the graph, essentially. Whereas the current conditions is an average, and the other future scenario conditions are for the full 50 years. So that's one of the big differences too.
Thank you, Christina.
And I just want to check in with you to see if you have a follow-up.
So Christina, you're saying that what is described as the current conditions is actually the 50-year period?
Right, so you want to describe that, Byron?
Sure. So the current condition scenario includes the full 50 years of hydrology to provide a baseline that we can then use to evaluate these projected scenarios. And so what's really current about it are the land use and the urban demands, but we still consider the full 50 years of hydrology to provide that baseline scenario.
Yeah, so it's a really good question, Anne. And I think it's worth.
So maybe you should, instead of calling it current, which I always think of means as of today, you might call it historical with current land uses or something to imply the Well, but even so, your original historical was a minus 20 TAF per year, and now it's a minus one. And I'm still, because your historical was 20, was 50 years also, wasn't it?
No, exactly. That's the difference.
Okay. Yes. It was 2000 to 2018.
Exactly.
So we just picked a dry period to compare, or perhaps, okay. So I think maybe the terms are a bit confusing, at least to me. Yeah. I still am struggling a bit to understand what has changed that there's such a difference. So,
okay. Go ahead, Byron.
I was just going to say that's a really good point. We struggle ourselves trying to explain these different scenarios, and you know, are somewhat reluctant to compare the historical to these scenarios because of that difference in the time period in particular.
Right. So on the slide, on the previous slide, on slide 34, that's why you don't see historical here, is because it is kind of comparing apples to oranges to compare historical to current. And so between these scenarios, when I use scenario as you're saying, okay, now we're gonna, a historical model run is developing all the inputs based on historical data. So, you know, hydrology, stream flows, measured stream flows, measured precipitation, land use, to the degree that we can change those things as we know that they did occur and change over time. That's kind of our historical model run. And then when it came to reporting out those numbers for this work, the period for average annual reporting was chosen to be 2000 to 2018. And one of the reasons for that is that as we look further back in time, the quality of historical data gets blurrier. So we have more confidence in the land use and the stream flows and the, you know, all those different kind of data inputs in the more recent couple of decades. And so that was kind of the chosen. Per the law, you have to look back 10 years. So we went a little bit further back than the 10-year requirement for historical, kind of evaluating historical conditions. But then when you do scenarios with groundwater modeling or other modeling, then you can start to kind of mix and match different pieces to explore different things. And so with the current scenario, it's the historical hydrology. So it's still the historical stream flows and historical precipitation inputs, all of that stuff changes year to year like it did. But now the current conditions, and this is confusing, but the current conditions are the more recent land use kind of footprint, which is what's driving demand for groundwater pumping and surface water use potentially also. So it's kind of like, okay, if we experienced with kind of today's land use and water demands, experienced the last 50 years of hydrology, what do those water budget numbers look like? And that's the current condition scenario results.
Okay, I just quickly, I would say for me trying to explain to someone why they needed to conserve or make other measures, telling people that we've gone from a minus 20 TAF deficit to a minus one doesn't make the argument very easy.
Yeah. I think one thing we could do to be able to compare apples to apples would be to compare to look at the average of 2000 to 2018 using the current conditions model result. Don't you think?
I think it would be good to simplify it so that it's more obvious to people like me, who will also be the people I have to go and talk to.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, we'll wrestle with that. Thanks, Anne. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Anne. It's really helpful just trying to make this as understandable and digestible as possible, particularly in your role as a as a SHAC member. So thank you for bringing that up. And then another SHAC member, Bruce Smith, has a question in chat, and this will be our last question before we go to an overview of next steps, since we just have 9 more minutes. And Bruce asks, can we get updates on progress of the AEM study and also updates on Dr. Todd Green's work? Are there any aerial views of study areas defining low recharge impacts in East Vina area?
Okay, I might need clarification on that last part. But yeah, so an update on the AEM study. We just had a call last week with some of the Stanford folks and Todd and others working on that project. Todd has some time in the next month. He's going to get kind of our current drafts of some of the HCM documentation that we've put together already, and then help continue to interpret the AEM data alongside the other well data and his geology expertise to frame up better defining kind of different aquifer zones in relation to hydrogeology. So that, like I mentioned before, we talked about, I think really over the next 2 months, so probably by the end of July, hopefully having some images and maybe some narrative to go along with that, and to also be able to evaluate our monitoring network of groundwater level monitoring wells, kind of synced up to that new updated picture of what the subsurface looks like in the Vina subbasin. So hopefully that answers that question. The goal would be to have that, I think, to the extent that we can, at least, that it's available to support GSP completion. We want to have that available by the end of the summer so that it's what we're working from when we talk about sustainable management criteria and the monitoring network and all of that. As far as east side, what was the second part, Tanya? About recharge on the east side.
Are there any aerial views of study areas defining low recharge impacts in East Vina area?
We may have to talk about that more just so I understand better maybe what you're asking, but what comes to mind is that because, as Byron described, the groundwater model does kind of have this spatial distribution of things, and one of the things we've just been recently talking about is having a map come out using the groundwater model output for deep percolation and highlighting kind of relative deep percolation for each model element throughout the model area to get an idea of where there are higher rates of recharge and where there are compared to that relatively low percolation occurring, which could be either from precipitation or from applied water. So that, I don't know if that's along the lines of what you're asking, but we can revisit that.
Any follow-up there, Bruce? Okay, perhaps we can follow up. I see that you're on mute. We can follow up with you independently if you would like. So we just have 5 more minutes, and so Christina, I'd like to hand it off to you to just provide an overview of our next steps.
Great. First I wanna thank Byron. Thank you for a lot of great information and work going into that and continuing to help us put numbers to these things and understand the water budgets better. So thanks a lot for that. I think next steps, one, want to let you know that this presentation, along with the pieces of the last SHAC meeting, will be posted on the Vina GSA website. So once those are posted, maybe we'll send out an email to the list too and let people know that that's available, and encourage you, especially if you're a SHAC member, to and weren't on today, we'll send out an email and hopefully those folks can view that and tune in to that before next week's SHAC meeting. So that's the other piece to mention. The Vina SHAC, which is the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, we'll be meeting next week on June 16th at 9 a.m. also in Zoom. And there's a couple other topics that will be returning from their previous meeting for discussion, and this is one of them. So The bulk of the content has been presented today and at the previous SHAC meeting. There will be a short overview presentation given by Byron to kind of set the stage and prompt discussion, but mostly just an opportunity for additional discussion about some of these things that were raised and additional feedback from the SHAC on how to make this more digestible as we continue to roll it out in different ways and make it relevant for the next stage of GSP development. So beyond that, the documentation associated with this work is being drafted, and we expect it to be available for public review within the month, less than a month from now, and for a 30-day comment period. So there will be an opportunity for kind of formal comment, written comments to be received, and then the documentation along with those comments will be reviewed and discussed by the SHAC at a later meeting as well, probably in September, I think we talked about, but whatever timing that works out to be. So all of this is laying the foundation for the other GSP components, and GeoSynTech is a firm that will be working on that. And I think we've got Joe Turner on today as well, and he'll be the project manager of that work. And so they will be the technical team taking all of this and moving into sustainable management criteria and building out the other pieces of the GSP. So that is to come, and they'll be getting up and running, I would say, in the next couple months or later this summer as well. So a couple things to come, and I just mentioned this, but the HCM the hydrogeologic conceptual model will be continue to be built out a bit more, taking advantage of Todd Green and his expertise on the AEM work. So stay tuned for that. I think we'll probably bring that as kind of a distinct topic because it's deep, both in complexity and high area of interest. So stay tuned for that. That will come. Another piece that is important and kind of complex in itself is groundwater dependent ecosystems. And Kelly Peterson in our office is taking the lead on that. And that's in development phase. And so that will come to the SHAC in the near future, in the next few months as well. And all behind all of this kind of work is the monitoring network that's providing information about groundwater level conditions and other things. And so that will also be part of the future conversation as we move into sustainable management criteria. So that's kind of where we're headed. I want to say too that if follow up, reach out to me. If you have follow-up questions, if there was a term that we kept using and that you're not familiar with, give me a call or shoot me an email and we can just chat about it. And just really trying to continue to build understanding as we continue to brave kind of this Sigma world together. So I appreciate you guys all taking the time today to join us and to dive into a lot of technical information with us.
Thank you so much, Christina, and to everyone who joined the call today. If you're interested in learning more or participating in the SHAC meeting, you can find those materials. They'll be posted by Thursday on the VINA GSA website, and an email will go out to the interested parties list. So thank you again, and we'll look forward to seeing you at future meetings.
Tanya, I have a question. I'm not able to raise my hand, apparently, but...
Here you go.
If I want to, or anyone, the SHAC participants want to put something on the agenda for the next meeting, what is the deadline, the timeline? How many days in advance does it have to be submitted?
Oh, Gary, that's a good question. So because we are a Brown Act compliant group, we do post materials by Thursday, 9 a.m., the Thursday before the meeting. So that would be this Thursday. And we try to finalize the agenda by the Tuesday. So that's today. So if you want to, if there's something that you would like on the agenda, I'd appreciate it if you would reach out to me.
All right.
After this call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Gary. All right, thank you very much. Have a nice rest of your afternoon, everyone.